You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm very pleased to be bringing you this interview with Nick Cody, an awesome, pumping powerhouse of a comedian. He's a really terrific live act. If you're going to be up at the Edinburgh Festival, you should get in and see his new show. I saw it in Melbourne, and that's where we caught up for this conversation. I just called him an awesome, pumping powerhouse of a comedian. With anyone else, that would seem too much. But you will see that Nick is one of those guys. Big, big beard, big guy, big personality, very, very warm, very, very funny. This is Nick Cody. Where shall we start? How was your show last night? I saw you two or three nights ago, or maybe even end of last week.
Yeah, end of last week. So Monday, I didn't have a show. We're recording this on a Tuesday. No Monday night show.
Okay.
I have the Mondays off here.
Everyone does. Lazy. Me included, and well, it's great.
If I'm at home, it's a nice thing, but anywhere else in the world, I'll work all the nights. Except yeah. Edinburgh, I think that middle Monday.
Middle Monday.
Yeah, that
I do middle Wednesday.
You do middle Wednesday.
Yeah, 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 because everyone does middle Monday, so then the clever kids do Tuesday, so I do Wednesday.
I take off Friday and Saturday. Yeah, no one's coming out then.
Cool. So because you live in Melbourne, so yeah. The Monday night is good
night
for
off.
You because you live sort of not too far away from here.
Yeah, pretty close by.
You've cycled over here.
Yeah.
And for the benefit of the listener who hasn't necessarily seen you, they can probably tell. I'm just wondering whether it's apparent from the sound of your voice that you are a kind of beardy, sporting, unashamed cycle short kind of guy. Like
They're not tight. They're not tight cycle shorts.
No, they're not. Okay, but
going to the gym after. They are gym shorts, definitely.
Yeah, okay. So that's simply that phrase.
They're bright orange.
Going to the gym after. That says a lot about what we need to know about Nick Cody, right? Of all the comedians who go to the gym, very small number.
Yeah.
I think you're in a much smaller camp of comedians who go to the gym and enjoy it. I mean, you sent me a text like in the first week of being here, like, I can hook you up with the gym if you want. I was like, why would I want that?
Well, I have to, especially during festivals, because I'll get unfit a bunch of times every year and then crawl back towards fitness and then it'll dip off again. So I feel in these month-long festivals, I look at my fitness, it's like a helicopter that's lost the rotor blade. We're going down. But the degree of how bad it ends up, that varies. Well, but I'm definitely going to be unfitter at the end of a festival than at the start.
Yes.
But then that...
You are... I don't think I've ever used this expression before, but I'm struggling to find an alternative. You're kind of a man's man, right?
But no, only in entertainment.
Luke Heggie syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah. No, but Luke Heggie is an actual manly man. Like, he can fix stuff, and he was a builder, and he's... worked in all these incredible jobs. He's got all these talents. He used to be able to fix boats. And I can't do any of that. I can't drive. I can't fix things. But it's just to be an alpha in the entertainment industry is very... It's like if you've watched sports once, who's this bloke?
True. That's true.
You know, it's
are you into comics? No. Whoa, who is this alpha guy?
The T-shirt I'm wearing, a T-shirt, the Grotto, which is the bar at the SAS base in Perth. And when I... when I catch up with those guys, like I've done a bunch of gigs for troops overseas, and I catch up with them, and I'm like the smallest little petite
Yes.
Guy around then.
But you're the only comic I know who has worn the T-shirt of an SAS bar. this is my working out clothes. Fine. Okay, so we get a sense of this. Now, this brings us neatly to your show that I saw a few nights ago. And one of the elements of it I loved is that you... I mean, I'm interested in what it feels like to you. Do you feel like there's a line by which you need to not be too... Laddie isn't the right word, but blokey.
Blokey, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Like you're definitely the victim of your stories.
Yeah.
Because in a way that Luke Heggie, for example, isn't. And I don't know how useful a metric that is. Luke doesn't go to the Edinburgh Festival, no matter how many times I fucking try and convince him to go back. But
he should too. I think I've seen his show 7 times.
Yeah.
I love
Someone told me they saw you in his audience and you were just speaking along with all the jokes.
Oh, yeah, I could sing along like I love it. I'll wake up in the morning and I'll just reel off Luke Heggie lines and my wife is like, "And that, you're not out of bed yet."
Yeah.
And I'm just
But something like he isn't the victim of his stories. Yeah. He's not the victim. He's very deliberately sniping at things and people that he hates.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what you have is an incredible kind of warmth on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to kind of talk about that. Like I wonder, I'm really interested in the decisions you've made about your stand-up because you're so natural that either you've made a couple of really good decisions early on or no decisions ever. Do you know what I mean? And it's just you.
I think it's more the decisions I have made, I've realised... I shouldn't try and make points. Like I'd love, there's some comics like Tom Ballard, who I just absolutely love, who can make these beautiful political points and in ways that things that I agree with, some things I don't agree with, but it's so funny and they're these great points. I'm not that person. If I try to make a point, it would sound like I'm reading something that I've already typed on a computer.
Okay.
But with stories and things, it does come out a lot more naturally. That's not to say, I'm not listening back when I'm building a show to the stories and trying to find out how I can get as many jokes in the story as possible. But I definitely enjoy that side more.
And have you tried, when you say you've learned that, is that because you've tried to make the point?
Yeah, for sure. Try to make points. And it just, it's
can
just
you give
not
us a specific example?
Oh, I wish I could. It'd have to be years ago that I've even attempted. I just don't bother talking about politics or anything like that because I just don't – it's not something that I read up on every day, so I'm not going to be on top of things. I'll read the news every day but not, you know, political opinion stuff every single day. So I just try and steer clear of that. I just think whatever I'm doing, it seems to be working, so I'm just trying to figure out how to make this better.
That's a really interesting thing. I wonder how many people will relate to that. Whatever I'm doing – seems to be working.
Yeah.
It's odd, isn't it? Because you, like, what do you think it is that you're doing that's working?
I don't know. Well, the thing that I get in every review ever, it sounds like he's a best friend you haven't met or he's a mate that you just could catch up with at the pub. And I used to hate that so much. I used to hate that.
It sounds really like you're being damned with faint praise, doesn't it? Like...
Yeah, it's annoying because there's no mate at the pub that's thinking callbacks and changing a word here and a little inflection here and putting bits in a certain order to make
sure
the crowd know enough about me so when I bring this up, they're going to be cool about that. And like I build the show, I want it to be funny first, but I've also got to make sure, you know, if I've got beheading jokes, not off the top. Probably poor choice of time. There's certain bits that I won't do at the start of the show. I build it so I can bring people in and they realise, okay, we trust him. Now I can talk about darker stuff.
So you mean it's kind of frustrating when people say he's like your best mate. You feel like, no, there's a lot of work goes into this.
Yeah, but I understand that it does look... I am just standing there looking very relaxed on stage, but I'm... And I am. Like, when I'm at the best shows I have, I'm very, very relaxed. But, of course, there's months leading up to just fine-tuning tiny little bits and making sure it all clicks together well.
But the relaxation element of it, and you've got a line in the show that I saw about... You're talking about your wedding and the speeches at your wedding.
Yeah.
And you're talking about most people are sort of afraid of public speaking, and you're like, this is my number one skill.
Yeah.
And you just, I've never seen anyone ooze so much confidence. It's like me giving a seminar. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, obviously I am the most comfortable man in the room, he said to 300 people in a packed room like that. You know, there is something incredibly charming about that level of ease on stage.
But it's only when I'm doing my stand-up stuff. Hosting, I don't like hosting things. I'm not
really
very comfortable. Yeah, making a speech, I don't feel as comfortable making speeches, but with stand-up stuff, I'm very relaxed. I'm in control of everything that's happening, and, you know, unless somebody yells something out.
Would you say you're more relaxed on stage in front of 300 people doing your hour than you are now talking about it to me?
I'd be more relaxed in the way that I know what's coming up.
I know what
to expect. But no, this is great. I love doing interviews and things. I mean, more, I don't like being the master of ceremonies for any sort of event. Okay. Like, I've had friends ask me to host their weddings and things, and to me that is way too much pressure. Way too much pressure.
Because it's their
big day. And I don't want that on me.
But you must know. I mean, the reason they've asked is because you'd be incredibly good at it. You'd be really confident. That surprises me.
Yeah. Why I don't. The pressure of that is just too much.
That's, have you ever done stand up at a wedding? Is it?
No.
I did once.
Oh, really? No. Yeah. No. Why would you?
Never do it again.
Everyone's not your day.
Everyone looking at me goes, "Why is he talking about himself?"
Stand up's the opposite. Yeah, like, it's my favorite thing about stand up. From the minute people walk in the room to my tour shows, I've picked everything. I've picked the lights. I've set up the lights in the way that I want them set. I've got a gobo, a big projection on the thing.
I noticed that. That's so funny. You've got a gobo of your own face.
Yeah, with a crown on.
Me and Asher were watching your show together, and at the end we looked at that, and Asher turned to me and went, "He's got a gobo."
Yeah.
A gobo, for those that don't know, is a kind of a metal stencil that goes in front of a big parkan light, such that it projects. I mean, usually the name of a nightclub in the 80s, but on this occasion, the face of the comedian.
Yeah, with a crown on top. The show's called On Fire. It's me on a throne as the poster. But all the music is handpicked, and the pre-show music, I've handpicked all that and put it in an order that I think is going to build a vibe in the room that I want to walk out to.
That's interesting. Okay. So the vibe of the... Oh, so you mean...
Because it's all over-the-top, ridiculous rap music. It's like Rick Ross, Lil Wayne, Drake, building up this big thing where beats drop and lights are sweating. And so I enjoy that. So when I come out, it's just like, "Hey, guys, how are we?" You know, it's just very different. It's a juxtaposition from the thing.
I don't know, for me that would be a juxtaposition. If I walked out like a small man going, "Hello," you know what I mean? Like that, I can see that kind of juxtaposition. But you seem to suit that kind of bombast.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I love that stuff. I do. I love growing up I loved wrestling, like WCW, WWF wrestling.
Yeah.
I loved entrances and big.
Oh, man.
Ridiculous.
I was never super into it, but every time anyone mentions WCW or that kind of stuff, I just remember seeing like a VHS cassette of a huge Royal Rumble, or I'm maybe getting the terminology wrong, where it's like there's this whole thing about like the what's he called, Ultimate Warrior?
Ultimate Warrior
couldn't be there because he's recovering from an injury, and then you get the drama of it's fantastic, and then you know you get like two-thirds of the way through the match, the good guys are getting pounded, the music plays, I just remember as a kid watching this thing of someone, the commentator, looking very believably surprised and going, "It's the Warrior music," and this guy running in and stuff like that. That's really funny.
I loved it when I was a kid. I'd just watch tapes time and time again.
It's incredible.
The trash talk, like the Ric Flair trash talk and the trash talking opponents, and I just find that stuff so funny because it doesn't fit in with stand-up. Like, I understand I've got a lot of self-deprecating stuff, but the last few years I've just sort of made an effort to give my shows very alpha titles, like Come Get Some, On Fire, Beard Game Strong, because so many shows are guys or girls just like, "How do I adult?" And I find it much funnier because I know in the shows there's going to be a lot about me fucking things up.
Yes.
Having the full confidence going in, like, I think I can do this, then I make a mistake, and then I get the bits out of me just living in this loop where it's like in the show I talk about, I've never skied before. And I was in Austria, and they offered me ski lessons, and I said, "Why would I need skiing lessons? I was very good at footy 15 years ago." Right? I'll be fine. I've got this, right? Yeah. And that happens so much in my life where I think, yeah, I think I can do this. It's a disaster.
That is interesting. I remember, I think that's when you first came to my attention, was sort of seeing posters of yours in Edinburgh. And yeah, beard game strong. It's super, again, it's kind of warm and big and frequently ginger.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's... That's the only thing. I designed that poster.
Yeah.
So it was sort of black and white.
It's modern,
image.
Yeah, it's,
yeah. Or not quite black and white, but the beard is red.
Yeah. And those, yeah, that kind of... it's interesting that decision to kind of go alpha. And it's interesting to sort of hear that word again, which is... Yeah, so many people. I remember Tom Gleason saying this years ago on the podcast, where he deliberately wanted to go in a different direction. You know, you see everyone's doing this at the moment, so you do something else. I mean, I guess you're one of those people. Here's a question. Given that you are an alpha and you're pretty, I mean, you know, like you say, within comedy.
Within the context of an entertainment industry.
Yeah, sure.
Probably.
Sure. I mean, it is ridiculous to describe someone as an alpha. Given that you're an alpha and I'm currently kneeling and I didn't intend to. I think sometimes when I am on stage, this is something someone who's very interested in comedy, very good at comedy, once said to me, and I went, oh God, yeah, that's interesting. He said, when he looks at me on stage, he was implying an audience as well, but he is thinking, well, why are you here? Like, what problems have you got that you're trying to deal with being here? We all know that kind of the you know, I can't adult very well. That whole kind of trope comes from, and it's a majority trope, but I guess that comes from I'm not very good, and that whole idea of I'm not good at life, this is why I'm on stage, because I'm complaining about how terrible I am at life. You know, it's you see comedy as like a loser bemoaning their loser status.
Yeah.
If you're someone who comes on and says, yeah, I mean, obviously you mess stuff up, but you're never in danger. Like, your dignity is never really in danger. Like, you're telling us as friends about a time you hilariously fucked something up. Do you know what I mean? Like, the wetting yourself in an elevator story. Yeah. Great story, great bit. But we're all on board.
Yeah.
So do you think, like, why are you there? Why are you on stage? Why stand-up comedy? Why are you having a great life somewhere? What have
this
you got
is a
to
great
complain
life.
About?
No. But it is a great life. I've loved stand-up since I was six. My parents, I still remember the record, an actual record, was Billy Connolly, the pick of Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
And my parents let me listen to that with headphones on. And then I'd stop it every time I didn't understand a bit, and I'd get dad or mum to come over and I'd play it to them and say, everyone's laughing, why are they laughing? And then mum and dad would sit there and break down why it's funny. So there's a song called Divorce.
Yes,
I was like, what's divorce? What is that? So mum and dad have to explain what divorce is to me, then explain why this has gone wrong and this is happening.
Okay.
Then I'd listen back and would laugh, like, I see why that's funny. And I just do that with so many comedy. I just loved it. I just love stand-up. So,
do you think there is a kind of a wave now of comedians who are doing it almost as an extreme sport rather than as a means of bearing their innermost? Do you think there are kind of comedians? I feel like in the UK there have been sufficient successful, I suppose. Someone else put this, or I can't remember who put it like this. It was almost like the Russell Howard effect, where you see someone who is a successful, handsome, very funny man. Not, I don't mean holding court. He's very funny. He's a brilliant comic. But when you see someone, you know, that inspires a generation of people who go, oh, right, it isn't about a weirdo complaining about how they don't fit into the world. It's about a successful person being successful.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then that inspires loads of people to do it. If you're... I'm interested when people come to comedy from a point of view of love rather than fear and anxiety and depression and guilt and shame and all those things.
But I have those things. Not depression, but would definitely have anxiety at times and fear of stuff. And they're great that you can... There is somewhere with stand-up, if you can make it funny, you can talk about it. That's my number one thing. It has to be funny. Nothing annoys me more than a show that's billed as comedy and it's not funny, and the person says, this show's not funny. And you go, well, why'd you call it comedy? It's insane. It's not fun. You're even saying it's not funny. I'm not saying it's not brilliant and they're heartbreaking, and I'm not saying any of those things. They can be all of that, dramatic and beautifully written and perfectly structured. But if it's not funny, I don't get why it's under comedy. If no one's laughing and their intent is to not make people laugh, what are you doing? What?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. But I want to press you on this point of like, why are you there? Right, you love doing it.
It's my favorite.
Is it just a thing that you've chosen
never.
Out of all of the options?
No option. I just dropped everything else. My parents knew in high school I was on an academic scholarship at a private school here in Melbourne, and I wanted to do law. My mum worked at a law firm as a PA receptionist for 35 years at the same law firm. And
Karen Cody.
Brutal sense of humour. And I wanted to do law, but mum knew my personality. And she took me into the law firm to get lawyers to talk me out of doing law.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Maybe
I could be an accountant. And mum's like, you're getting great scores in accounting. You would hate accounting.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to do a trade. And mum's like, you're not doing a trade. You don't get up that early in the morning. Unless you go into sport, you're not going to get up to, you know.
So already now we're forming a picture of why you are comparatively well-adjusted for a comedian. That is some sensational parenting.
Yeah. I got pretty lucky in that regard, for sure.
Why do you think she was so keen for you not to do something like that? Have you got brothers and sisters?
Yeah. Younger sister.
And what does she do?
She does like an office job.
Okay.
God, I never remember the term. There's so many terms for just office job. I just know it's an office
like
job.
Something like project manager or
It'd
something.
Be something yeah, like that. Something, yeah, okay. I'm sorry, Leah.
Yeah.
I don't know. My dad, I can't explain his job. There's always something new on the business card that he laughs at even. It's like, look at this wanky title that this is given this week, you know? I got very lucky.
So this is Nick. We've got time for one quick email, a quick donation-based blurb, and two little Edinburgh-related plugs. So let's start with the email. A listener called Grant, hello Grant, wrote to me with an emotional response to the Pippa Evans podcast that I just thought I'd read out. This is quite a lovely email to receive. Grant says, I've enjoyed your interviews, and it's often been your style and understanding that I've found more engaging than the guests. I mean, that's very flattering. I don't know how I feel about that. Obviously, I'm trying to bring you the guests, right? But thank you. He says, however, Pippa was so heartwarmingly honest in a fantastically self-aware way. Flawed and fabulous, grounded enough to be both terrific and shit, and okay with the transition between. I find myself in love with that expression of personality. So this message is to thank you for all the podcasts and to say that I'm pleased that it's not my sense of guilt that now persuades me to donate, but rather the depth of my engagement and enjoyment. Thanks for all your hard work, for which I have given nothing in return until now. Very well written email, Grant. Thank you. I've got to agree with you. I'm sure Pippa is indeed, as you say, grounded enough to let me read out this email saying that that she can be both terrific and shit and okay with the transition between. I think that's very well put. I think we'd all like to be a little bit more like Pippa Evans. Fabulously self-aware, as you said. If you're listening to this, not Grant, but you, if you're listening to this and you haven't yet caught up with the Pippa Evans podcast, do check back over the back catalogue and see some fabulous ones you've missed. Remember, everyone I get on the show is someone I'm very excited about talking to. So even if there are names you don't know, I know some people start off choosy and then become floozies over time and go back and listen to all of them. I chatted to a Parisian comedian or an American comedian currently resident in Paris. Hello to you. And I chatted to him at a preview I did last night. And he was saying that he has started getting seriously into the podcast and is now up to Jen Kirkman, which, I mean, is that 2 years ago in real time? I can't remember when we did Jen. Was that must have been my first trip to Montreal. It must be 2 years ago this week, because I'm off to Montreal this week to bring you guests, including W. Kamau Bell, K. Trevor Wilson, Sugar Sammy, and also some other people if they get back to my email. So hopefully I'll be bringing bringing lots of those to you soon. But yeah, thank you very much, Grant. I appreciate it. Thanks for bringing up donating. I love the way that you say it's not my sense of guilt that persuades me to donate, but the depth of my engagement and enjoyment. Well, that's what I'm going for. If you are listening to this and you're enjoying this show, if your engagement and your enjoyment with this show is deep, as Grant's is, then you, like him, can start a regular monthly payment, a subscription to the podcast. And I want to be clear about this, because this is I'm pleased that it works like this. I'm not one of those guys that charges you for extra content, right? I give you all the content I can. If there are any extras, like the recent Simon Money extras, you can find all of them at comedianscomedian.com/extras. And you get access to them without paying. All we need is your email address that will unlock those extras for you. And obviously, you will receive one of my almost quarterly emails, advertising t-shirts and the like, and upcoming live shows and stuff like that. But you don't pay for that. What I'm wanting to build here is a community of people who are making subscription donations to the show in return for precisely nothing but a good feeling. I don't want to sell you the content ever. If you can't afford to be a subscriber, you get no more or less than anyone else. But if you are a subscriber, if you are a donor to the show, which you can become yourself at comedianscomedian.com/donate, then you get a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling because you know that you are supporting the thing that you love. You don't get any extra stuff for it. Some people might say that's a cheap way of doing it. I honestly believe that that's how I want it done. I want people who can't afford to donate to get exactly the same stuff as people who can. On that note, when it comes to the t-shirts, and thank you if you've been emailing saying, Stu, where's my t-shirt? It was months ago. It was the pre-sale, right? So we've done a whole pre-sale. That's now concluded. The t-shirts are being printed literally today. They have been held up by a week thanks to a broken machine, but they will all be being posted next week in real time, and you should get them shortly afterwards. There's a bunch of you have ordered a t-shirt via the pre-sale, and anyone that didn't get to do that, if you didn't manage to get in there in time, they will be available probably after the Edinburgh Festival when I can focus on something other than my show. Quick chat about the show with you in the post-amble if you care to stick around, but do come along to that. Remember the things we're pushing now at the Edinburgh Festival, and if you're not coming to Edinburgh, I'll try and make this brief so as not to wind you up or make it like a knife in your heart, as a recent emailer wrote. Everyone's a comedian. This is the experiment. I think we're closing submissions now. We've got over 100 submissions for my crowdsourced hour of comedy. I'm going to be giving a voice to those people who will never set foot on stage themselves. That is going to be on the 14th of August at 7:30 p.m. at a venue called Subway, which used to be called Movement, and that's on Cowgate in Edinburgh. So turn up for that. It's free. It's unticketed. Get there. Let's ram the room. Let's have a good time. Go easy on me. Be nice. This has never been done before by anyone, let alone me, and I've no idea whether it will be good. I am confident that you guys are funny, but of course the rules of this experiment dictate that I haven't read any, not a single one of your submissions, so it's everything to play for. Don't leave me hanging, guys. On the 15th of August, the following day, the Tuesday night, get tickets. If it hasn't already sold out, it will sell out. Come and see me take part in the wrestling. Real comedians, real wrestlers. I don't know how much of it's embargoed. I don't know what I can tell you about it. I've done a bunch of training sessions. I don't think it's illegal for me to tell you I suplex a grown man. Please come along to that. We're putting so much work into it. Max and Ivan have created this incredibly wonderful thing, and it remains the first ever wrestling, which was some 6-7 years ago, remains one of my top 5 live things I've ever seen in my life. I loved it. I'm so thrilled to be taking part. So do jump onto the Pleasance website and get yourself a ticket for that. And of course, finally, once again, free, unticketed, my own show is going to be on in the Liquid Rooms Annex at 3:45 every day from the 5th to the 27th of August. It's called Like I Mean It. The previews are concluded. I've got a week now to run off to Montreal, and then I get back and boom, we travel to Edinburgh with the tiny family and we get stuck into that show. So please come along, and come along early if you're a big laugher and a big loudmouth who wants to tell all your mates about how much you enjoyed the show. That's all the chat for now. Let's get back to Nick Cody, and I'll give you a little post-amble afterwards. Let's get back to lovely. Isn't he lovely? Let's get back to Nick. So, and I don't mean to kind of push this metaphor if this isn't the case, but I know you're a sports fan. I know you're a Ultimate Fighting fan.
Yeah.
And you've got material about it. It's very funny.
And mixed martial arts.
Mixed martial arts. And I was interested when we were chatting in a bar a couple of weeks ago about, you sort of said you had not even a theory, but sort of a worldview about your place in stand-up.
regarding almost different weight classes.
Yeah.
So I'll ask you about that in a second, but I think the point I wanted to try and make about it was that it's almost like, I sometimes describe comedy to people as, it's like an extreme sport. It's like jumping out of a plane. That's the addictive nature of it. It's like, once you've done it, how can I make the rest of my life about only doing this?
Yeah.
And I suppose I'm also slightly fudging a metaphor, an analogy that Alan Davies, British comic, used years ago. He said comics are either golfers or self-harmers.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? There's like these two camps. You either get on with it and enjoy playing a round of stand-up comedy, or you're out there cutting yourself on stage.
Yeah,
broadly one of the camps. So with respect to that kind of analogy, does that make sense to you, that comedy's kind of like a sport? It is. It's like you've discovered you're good at a thing.
Yeah.
It makes you happy. And
you can train hard. You can get better.
Train hard and get better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
try and be the one thing I do understand, though, is it's subjective. So I grew up playing sports, Australian rules football, American football in my teen years. And the thing about sports is, if somebody kicks 10 goals and somebody kicks 7, I heard Patrice O'Neill once, a US comic, say the thing he didn't like about comedy is that somebody worse than him can make more.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if Michael Jordan scores 40 points and Kevin Garnett scores 42, Kevin Garnett will get a bigger contract. But comedy's subjective. It's my favourite thing about it, though, is that there is something for everyone. Like at Melbourne Comedy Festival, the fact I meet people in Melbourne that still haven't been to see a comedy show at the Fest, it's like, there is something for you.
Mm-hmm.
There is everything there, you know. But I do get...
sorry. We'll continue this point as the Boutros kicks off in the background.
I'm very competitive, but I just make it against myself. I try and make it against myself. So did I do better than the show before? Did I get this right? Am I doing better than last year and the year before? How's it looking going forward? But I definitely put heaps of pressure on myself. Because growing up with sport, I had a coach and my parents that were awesome in the way that after a game would end, they'd say, how would you rate yourself out of 10? And I could say, this game, 7.5. And they'd go, yeah, well, we think it's a 6.5 because this and this and this. Why do you think 7.5? This and this. All right, cool. Next game, I could think it was a 6, and they could say 8, or it could be a 3 and a 5.
This is your parents.
Yeah, and my coach, and we'd talk about that. I'd do that with stand-up stuff. Like, I'll know, on stage, very calm and relaxed, but if I'm a tiny bit off on an inflection, on a tagline, in my head, I'm like, shit, that could have been better. Fuck it, next time. We'll get them next time, you know? But in the moment, I am, in my head, breaking it down as I'm going along. Why did you look over there? You could have put, you know, your movement could have been better during that bit. And I'm doing that, throughout the set.
There's loads to talk about here. That's fascinating. So one of the things, I remember you saying when you did the Conan, Conan set, you messed up the word. And I think the word
fucking
was dribbling.
Dribbling, which is hilarious.
You tripped over the, you dribbled
to dribble
over
on the word dribble.
Fantastic. So you were gutted about that.
Shattered. Shattered.
And Conan came over.
In the moment.
He was like, great job, and it was a great gig.
Yep. And then I mentioned to him that I'd slipped up on a word, and he said, that's the most comedian thing I've ever heard. Like, you've flown from Australia, you've done well on your very first US TV set, and you'll think, the flub on that word. But in my head at the time, I was not, because it's a tagline, I'm looking up the roof. I've slipped up on dribbling, but there was a big laugh from the punchline that in my head, I remember the moment clearly. I'm looking up at the roof and I went, in my head, I've gone, you flubbed that. The crowd didn't hear because they're laughing, but it will be picked up 100%. And so already I'm like, fuck!
And they won't edit in Conan. They won't tidy it.
Cut people's sets down. Yeah. I've seen many sets that they've, because people have just blown out, gone way over time, and I've seen them cut sets back. But I knew that it's too small
Yeah, for you most couldn't people, it out. No, no, no.
Yeah, and it's most... I think the majority of people would not know, but I know, and comics would know.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? The difference between what comics know. Like, you know, comics can see comedians look at their watches.
Yeah.
Apparently, humans can't see that.
Yeah.
That's not a thing that registers.
Yeah.
So let's go back to this sporting analogy.
Yeah.
If you're putting... I mean, A, that is so far from my experience of being a sport... Well, I was going to say, from the point of view of being a sportsman, appraising your performance as a child, as a younger person, having parental pressure on your...
No pressure.
Not unpleasant.
Actually, no pressure from my parents to do anything.
Okay.
Never. You happy? Yeah. Great.
Great. That's good. As a parent who wants their kid to be happy, that's great to hear.
That's all I can do, you know.
But the mentality of going, right, that was a 6.5. Next time I've got to be better, and putting pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that as an approach to life because it's not really something I've ever experienced, you know. And I'm interested in it in terms of comedy, given that comedy can't be summed up like that. And of course you can follow some. Of course you can have a night and get more applause breaks.
For sure.
And then have a night and get less applause breaks.
But I don't even judge it on that. No. But I know that's not a better gig. That I'll break it down. I just look at my performance. The crowd can do whatever they like. That I'm not in control of that.
Aren't you?
Well, my performance may dictate how they react. Obviously, it's a fair bit of it. But then there's a bit that's up to them that I can't, it's out of my hands.
That's interesting because you'd drive yourself mad if you were chasing.
Oh, of course.
I've got to get them to.
No.
You know, they didn't laugh at that bit. But no. It was provided you can think.
I have bits in my show that I'll have little throwaway lines that I know that are taglines, but I'm very dismissive about them. And it's the thing that I'm liking more with the reviews when they say, it's so calm, it looks like he's not trying. I'm throwing out tiny little things at times, and if they get a laugh, I know the crowd is switched on. And if they don't, I just go, all right, we'll throw them another one in a few minutes and just see what's happening.
Okay. Is that then satisfying if you're thinking, I'm being better than this gig is going, you throw in one of them, they don't get it, that allows you to go, these guys don't get it.
Yeah.
They're not my favourite people. They're not, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I don't hate a crowd or anything. There's some I'll be frustrated, like, that crowd was a bit shitty, but I'm just not the person they wanted to see. I understand that.
So you were saying before about your kind of UFC metaphor about weight classes. That's kind of also a means of a structure through which do you get envious of other people? Because I think the context of that conversation when we had it was about, like, look, they're out of my weight class. It's not a problem.
Yeah. Well, there's a... Of course, you'd be lying if you said you'd never get a little bit of how's this person get this?
Yeah.
But it is minimal, because there's a quote, I bring him up in my show, Conor McGregor, the Irish UFC fighter that I love. He's got a quote, winners focus on winning, losers focus on winners. There's no why you're looking at anyone else. Like Edinburgh Fringe... How I justify, because people say there's 3,000 shows. And I said, well, unless 2,999 shows are blocking the box office to stop people from buying tickets to my show, or they're all getting together and setting my theatre on fire, they're doing nothing. It's up to me to get people in and put on a good show. I hope all 3,000 shows are excellent. That would be the best. But yeah, you can't worry about other people too much.
And did you go on?
Sorry, the UFC rankings thing, or the divisions.
Yeah.
There'll be, you know, I just say I'm in the straight white bearded male division. There's heaps of us. How am I doing in comparison to the rest of the people in that division? That's all I'll look at. Some comics will go, well, how come I don't have the thing Auntie Donna has? What do you mean? The unbelievable three-man sketch group, they're not even in the same sport.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at them?
Yeah.
You know, it's like a soccer player complaining that a netballer won a netball trophy.
That is really interesting.
What are you looking at?
They're not in the same sport.
Thing. So why are you focusing on that?
They're getting more baskets than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. You're playing baseball.
Yeah. It's very different. But then again, I know even the comics that I'd look at as people similar to myself or I'm similar to them, we're all just doing stand-up. Just do your best stand-up. That's just want to get better every year.
And when you mentioned earlier on, you said that's, you know, you've got that kind of, you said train hard, get better. That mm-hmm. was your, that was your thing when you were younger. That was a train hard, get better. How does that, how do you approach training hard and getting better in stand-up?
Spots. I'm terrible at sitting down at a computer and writing, but I'm happy to do 5, 6, 7 spots in a day if that's possible mm-hmm. to work out the stuff, record, listen back. As I'm building the bit or the chunk, I'll listen back. Yeah, swap that there, change the tone at the opener, maybe move that little bit further into the show so people understand more about you. So by the time it gets there, just the sentence alone without any jokes will get a laugh because that you've set up your personality and the things you're into and things you don't like. I've got a bit in the show this year where I talk about going to a vegan barbecue straight from a bar where I've been watching the UFC, and it's a bad mental space. You should separate those weeks apart, right? But I say, I went to a vegan barbecue. It was a Lucia choice. It's the name of my wife. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
And that gets a laugh because within the first 40 minutes, I've built up who I am, who my wife is, our personalities. So as soon as I just say, that's her choice, and I just say it as a little throwaway thing, but people will laugh at that because they know
yes, gotcha.
What she's like
yes.
and what I'm like in comparison. So yeah, the train hard. I've just got to do lots of spots and just make sure it's...
You are one of the very few, loads of comics on this podcast say, I record loads of my spots. Most of them go, oh, I never listen back. Can't bring myself to listen back.
I'll only listen back when I'm building the stuff, when I'm putting it together, and I won't listen to every single one, but sometimes I might one day sit down and listen to 3 spots back to back.
God, just I don't think I've ever
8-10 minutes, but it is excruciating. Yeah. And I'll only listen out for the stuff that I know I'm trying to fix.
Yes, okay.
There's no point in listening to the whole thing. Like if there's an opening joke that's always been working and it worked again, what sort of arsehole would sit there and...
Yes, well done, me.
But if there's a bit that's bombing, listen to that. And just what's going on? Why?
Does that approach... do you recognise... Obviously, that there's very strong things about that approach. I don't know if the listener can hear the Boutros singing in the background.
Yeah, he's having a great time.
He's having a great time. He should be napping. I should also point out that his mum is looking after him. We haven't just locked him in a cupboard. There's definitely good things about that approach, that kind of methodical approach. I do that sort of thing. I wonder sometimes in my own practice whether that methodical approach runs the risk of being workmanlike. Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
Whereas actually, like, what I might want more kind of flights of fancy and more wandering and more loose stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what I'm doing is I'm getting very good at honing the thing that is already there.
Yeah. But I also, it's never written out fully. So I always give myself room to move around in bits. I believe it was your interview with Burr saying he doesn't stick to the exact same set list in that order every night.
Mm-hmm.
I'll switch stuff up just to throw myself off.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll actually find other links and things and just try and stay loose in the moment. Mindful, you know. As soon as I lock it in, the performance is robotic. I don't enjoy it. It never goes as well. So I have to make sure I stay loose and I can play around and, I'll switch stuff up in the set list, change different orders. There's some things in my tour that have to be in a particular order for callbacks and things later on. But the rest I can... The other night I just opened with a chunk that's normally 20 minutes in just to see what happens.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I totally get that. But I think what I'm asking is in the process which for you has become the process, the method which mm-hmm. for you has become the process and it's very story-based. So a lot of your stuff is mm-hmm. this crazy thing happened to me. And I think I read a review of yours that said he's got a lifetime of bad choices ahead of him through which to find more material.
What's always funny is that I don't think that's going to happen. That's the thing I find. So when I say on start, I just do not learn from these mistakes. I just know I can say in the next year, I want to do this and this and this. And I'll say, it's going to be a bit of a boring year. I don't think anything will happen. Oh, well, I'm going to have to build a show somehow. We're going to get a show. I just don't know. But something will happen and I will make a poor decision. That is, it's just, I know that about myself now. You're going to look like a dick at some point in the next 12 months.
Because you've written 7 hours now?
Yeah, but three and a half or anything decent. Three and a half, I would not even.
But yeah, sure.
I started when I was 19. Jeez. So I jumped in early and just tried to punch out it. But they were not hours. If you could get 2.5 minutes out of my first hour, I'd be very surprised.
but it worked well enough for you to keep going.
Yeah.
So what was that? Were you just coasting on what, charm?
No, just that.
Like, how did you get away with it if it was that bad?
Well, I didn't. Like, it wasn't good.
Okay.
I didn't get away with it. But every year it gets better. And I love stand-up. So Louis C.K.'s Netflix special, 2017. I watched that the other day. Poor mistake watching it before I go and do my show.
Yeah.
Because the thought I have... It's two thoughts at the simultaneous there. Shit. Why would I watch this? This is a master delivering an incredible hour. And then the second thought is just keep working hard. That's all anyone does.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's really interesting to hear interviews with Louis C.K. I mean, he was kind of video podcasting like 15 years ago, something nuts.
Yeah.
And you sort of hear about him being 18 or 20 and dashing around New York on a motorbike and going in between 10 spots a night, and the rest of the guys, keep going. Just keep going.
Yeah. You've just got to turn up. If you don't turn up, it's not going to happen. That doesn't mean to say if you turn up, it will happen. But if you don't, it definitely won't.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, that's the level I love stand-up at, that... When I was an open micer, I flew to New York to watch Louis at Carnegie Hall record his album Word, and the next night watch Patrice O'Neill tape Elephant in the Room.
No way.
Yeah.
You saw the taping of Elephant in the Room.
I was at the taping of Elephant in the Room and Word, the Carnegie Hall. But the gig that I think comedians freak out the most about is I was 19 at the Opie and Anthony show in Philadelphia where Bill Burr got heckled.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. I'd worked at a summer camp in Oregon and loved Opie and Anthony.
This is the Philly one where
Philly incident on YouTube.
Yeah.
I was 19 in the crowd. I couldn't afford a flight, so I caught an Amtrak across America. It took 3.5 days or something insane.
Jesus Christ.
And then a train down to Camden, New Jersey.
And you were rewarded with one of the most memorable...
It was awesome, yeah.
So in which
I love stand-up.
He basically... everyone was bombing, the crowd sucked.
So no. Only a couple people bombed.
Okay.
A lot of people went great.
We get it from the horse's mouth now.
Yeah. Okay. So there was a Philly comic, Jimmy Schubert, who was on earlier, who got booed off. And he booed off because he came out and just went straight into material where Opie and Anthony, this radio show, rabid fan base.
Yeah.
Crazy people. There's 12,000 people in an amphitheater, and it's crazy. And he comes out and just goes straight into material.
Yeah.
Doesn't start off, Opie and Anthony fans, what's up? Like, if anyone did that, the crowd would go, then stop.
Of course, of course.
He's just come out. So I was at Starbucks yesterday.
Yeah, right.
Booed off. And Tracy Morgan was on after him, and he's like, if you do that to a white guy, oh man, I'm terrified about what's going to happen to me, you know? And, then somebody got sort of booed later on, and then Burr was on, and he started a bit that he didn't know they'd been playing on the radio.
Okay.
As like a teaser for the upcoming event.
Okay.
And they started booing him, and he turned on him. And
That's fascinating. Six
years after that, I opened for Burr at the Sydney Opera House as a part of Just for Laughs Sydney for 3 nights, and on the Saturday night, asked him if he could sign the ticket, and he lost his mind.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you were 19, traveling to America to see stuff because you were just like, this is
I worked at a summer camp, and I used the money from the summer camp to go to New York and just try and see shows. Okay.
So that might explain why. I mean, I think of you as someone who is like, I kind of don't think of you as an Aussie act. I think of you as an international act. You get everywhere, right?
You said before the pompous thing. I don't want this to sound pretentious, right? But with stand-up now, I see comics in as I'm starting to build stuff, and they'll have a bunch of Melbourne references and things that only Australians will know. But I know it's a limited amount of time here. A lot of time's going to be overseas. So I can't be talking about a Mikey card in Serbia or in London or in the US. And that is, I just realised I'm having my own little pretentious thing. I've got to make sure it is an international.
Yeah, you've got to write universally. Yeah.
But I also like the fact that you can slip in Australian type things and people will get on board if you explain it well enough.
Yeah.
I had a bit about performing for the SAS and meeting a guy, Mark Donaldson, who's a Victoria Cross recipient. And in the States, I'll say, before I start this, SAS is like SEAL Team 6, the Navy SEALs. Victoria Cross is Medal of Honor. Got it? And everyone goes, yep. And then you can just do the story. Yeah. And people are fine.
That's fascinating. Yeah. It's weird. I'm converting cultural references here. There's one line in my show where I would normally say, you know, you look at a biker doing 90 miles an hour on the motorway. And I have to say, a bikie doing 110 on the freeway. But I really make a meal of bikie, as I'm sure all British comedians do here. I get 5 minutes out of bikie and then go, doing 110 on the freeway. This is just painful to have to say. But yeah, that's interesting.
I already know there's bits in my show this year that for Edinburgh, I'll either have to cut or word different. But then you're losing some of the punch.
So which way around are you doing it? Is this show going to Edinburgh?
Yeah.
So that's the other way around to the way most Australian acts do it? Australian acts run in the show in Edinburgh and then bring it to Melbourne.
Oh, really? No, I think it's the opposite.
Oh, no. They run
because God, you're in Edinburgh for a month.
Yes, I'm sorry, I've got it.
You want the show to be going well, so you feel good. Edinburgh's tough enough.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. I did this show in Edinburgh, and now I've brought it.
Yeah.
I didn't run it in Edinburgh. I did it in Edinburgh, and then got the chance to do it here. So yeah. So you're doing the opposite, which is getting really. Okay. What have you learned from being a touring act, like an international act? Because you've been, you know, did I see you in Melbourne? I can't remember. Did we?
Montreal.
I mean, Montreal, obviously.
Montreal, we ran into each other.
Yeah, I did see you in Montreal.
And so, I saw you in LA at the podcast festival a couple of years ago.
There we go. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Right. Okay. That was I really remember that. So, and we both come out of this bit of the conversation looking very well traveled. thanks for bringing that one up. Like, that's something you've had your sights on since day one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Montreal?
Well, no, I mean, just the world.
International act. Yeah, for sure.
In a way that I guess, I don't think I mean, it was a while before when I started doing stand-up in the UK and I was starting in London, it was a while before I thought, I want to do the world. I just I just wanted to do comedy.
Yeah.
But I think it sounds like you've always been like, no, through the back of the head.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, and there's a thing here, there's financial things in Australia that are tempting. I have not been offered one because I don't aim for one. Or I've done a lot of radio work, like guest spots and things, some breakfast radio here in Australia. You could start off on $250,000 and it just goes up. And then there's TV roles, but again, hosting things, I'm not a fan of. I'm hosting a show. I've hosted it already. 10 episodes of a show that's coming out in Australia later in the year that I got sold as Tosh.0.
Yep.
But it was more Australia's Funniest Home Videos.
Oh. Okay. And are you voiceover or are you physically standing there?
The host.
How do you feel about it?
Had a wedding and a tax bill, man. I don't give a shit. Okay. I got lucky. I was the face of the Telstra ads for the Samsung S7.
No way.
Then they started fucking blowing up on planes. And I was like, woo, got out of that.
I love it. That's so on brand for you. It's like, get Cody, do your advert, phone blows up.
Yeah. I think I could have pitched it better now. Yeah. So those ads never got shown. But no, what I mean by that is I just love stand-up. and obviously UK and the US are where it's biggest.
Sure. And you want, what you want is to tour. I think I read an interview with you earlier. You were talking about what actually what you want is to be touring. You you want a level of, you want a Bill Burr, Louis CK kind of.
Yeah.
I'm a big actor and I do massive theatres.
Yeah, for sure.
Arenas. Do you want to do arenas?
I don't know. I saw Louis in an arena in Dublin last year. Like, again, this is how much I love stand-up. My Monday off, the middle Monday in Edinburgh last year, I get on a flight to Dublin, go straight to Three Arena to watch Louis, then the next morning fly back to Edinburgh to do the show. Like, Louis's here. Can I see him? Only if you go to Dublin. Cool.
Yeah,
45 minutes.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say,
I caught a train once.
When he first announced the dates, I think the first UK dates he announced were London. I was like, that's the middle of Edinburgh. And I started looking into flights. I Googled a few flights. So glad I didn't buy one because then he came to Edinburgh.
Yeah, like, but I missed him.
Yeah,
I couldn't see him in Edinburgh. But the arena, I don't know. I just started watching Kevin Hart's special.
Yeah.
It's so big. It seems crazy. I don't know if it's the right thing for stand-up.
Speaking of Kevin Hart, I'm a big fan of his social media approach, his mailing list approach, as detailed as an episode of WTF that he was on. Oh my God, right?
Yeah.
So taking email addresses, building a database. He's been doing that for 10 years, going hard at every gig. Wham, huge star. Obviously, that's not the only thing involved. And we all know comics who should put more time into their writing and performing than they do their social media, you know, whatever.
Harley Breen once used the term about a local comic who will go unnamed. He's got a black belt in marketing, white belt in comedy.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. We've seen a bit of that. You know, we could all point to that. Where do you stand on the marketing part of it, given that if your ambition is to do huge venues?
I should get better at, like, mailing lists and things like that, for sure. I've also got my own podcast that I've only put out a few episodes of. Because it's fun. It just, I don't wake up in the morning thinking about it. I wake up and think stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, it's almost the first thought. It'll be something to do with either me, as I've seen something that I found hilarious, or me thinking about a stand-up thing later, or could I go to this place and do stand-up? Could I do this? That's all I think about. I should probably focus more on when it comes to comedy, that's what I'm thinking about, just stand-up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the podcast would be like, Nick, you haven't released one in 8 months. Oh, shit, that happened, did it? Oh, well. But stand-up's always on the...
Okay.
The marketing, though, I should get better at. Some local comics do give me a bit of shit because I will, like my show this year called On Fire, and the promo pics are inspired by Conor McGregor photo thing on a throne.
Okay.
Chilling out on a throne. I just find it so ridiculous. For stand-up. The fact that I am going to walk out and just talk into a normal microphone.
Yeah.
It's not a golden one, right? I find that fun to do that sort of stuff. But I definitely do some social media braggy type posts, without a doubt.
Okay.
A lot of self-deprecating. But there are times where, like the other year, I put up a photo in business class saying 5 years ago I was taking $1 Tiger flights to Perth to do $50 pub gigs, and now I'm on business class flying to do a gala. And I put that down half for me.
Yeah.
Like, hey, man, just remember, like, I can scroll through my Instagram feed and go, it's getting better.
Yep.
It's getting better. It's getting better. It's getting better. And then half to just, because I think Australia's got the tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah, without doubt.
You can do well to a point, then fucking pull your head in, mate. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't like that. That's all. I love rap music and the UFC, and I love that over-the-top.
Kind of
peacock,
like,
for sure. Yeah. As long as you back it up, which is where all the stress comes in with making sure the show gets better. Because you're a piece of shit if you strut out and then put on a bad show.
Yeah.
But if you pull it off, excellent.
So let's just come back then to this idea of putting pressure on yourself.
Mm.
Because I think you've got real clarity of purpose. That's almost, you know what I mean? By picking, you've picked a goal there. That's a smart goal, right? Touring.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do. I'm not going to bother writing a sitcom. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to write jokes, do jokes, travel everywhere, do jokes.
But also see that if I did write something, if I put time into that, it could help the tour.
Yeah.
Which I do think about, like,
so do you, hey, stupid, do you then do
stop
that?
Grinding out, just these incremental, small increments is climbing up.
It's
on touring.
Fascinating, isn't it?
But then you go, do you write a thing? Will that help stand up? Or do you take a job to try and get more people in?
Yeah.
Or do you just push ahead?
That's it. Because I'm always of the... I've always been of the opinion you just turn up and work. Just turn up and work. You want to do something. This is when I was a street performer. Just turn up with the case. Bang out a show. Bang out a show. Get better, get better, get better. Until you're sort of unstoppable.
And but then you know that, comics get caught in a loop.
Exactly.
And they don't go any further than that.
Exactly that. So there's that fear of, like, you can work hard and you're still
but
not...
But it's not smart.
But it's not smart.
Yeah. You got to work smart as well. And that's where, like, Edinburgh's helped a lot in the sense that, like, got Conan off the back of it, got European tour off the back. A lot of people come to Edinburgh to see shows. And when I first went in 2015, I got offered a 40-seater or a 170-seater. And so I took the 170. Like, if I'm turning up with a show called Beard Game Strong,
yeah,
what sort of beta move would it be to go, come see this alpha hero? By the way, I didn't back myself for 170. I only backed myself for a 40. And then last year, they're like, do you want the 170 again or there's a 250? Show's called Come Get Some. Put me in a 250. And I'll hate if it's not... I know at the start it's always slow, but then when you get those couple of sold outs in a row, I'm like, here we go. I knew worked hard. I thought about the I put in all this effort and backed myself. Because it is a big...
Yes, it is.
Big move to come in. That it is peacocking in a way.
170.
Where are you starting? 170. Who knows it? What are you from? Nothing. Just stand up.
So what happened? What was the lowest turnout you got in your 170?
That first night, I think it was 38.
Okay.
And I was devastated.
Which room was it? What was the 170?
Assembly, George Square, Studio 2.
Is that like a lecture
theatre?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
170.
And when numbers are down, I get, yeah, because I'm very competitive. I want it. It's a part of it.
Yep.
I can get better. I can get better numbers. What are we doing?
That's on my hats off to you.
I get frustrated at the start of the day.
Hilarious.
I'm frustrated at the start of the day about numbers. But then sounds pretentious or whatever, but I'm like, if I do a good job, if I do the best job I can do, it'll get better.
And are you out on the street flyering your own show?
No, not anymore, no.
But for that 170?
I did for you, no.
So where are the people coming from? How are you going to get
them? Well,
no,
there's flyers.
Yeah.
In Edinburgh.
Yeah.
There are flyering.
And are you investing?
Word of mouth.
Did you get taken over there? Did you get kind of looked after?
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got someone investing in you in a kind of, we're going to put some money in and it's going to work out.
Which I wouldn't go until that happened.
Yeah.
And I'm happy I waited years. You've got to say no to stuff as well. Some comics ago, I'm going over expecting to lose $8,000 and then the high school accounting economics student comes out like, why the fuck would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense to me.
But it's a hard choice,
like,
isn't it?
You're going into it with the mentality of my month's work, I am as good as minus $8,000. Why would that be in your head? I have the opposite. I want, if I'm going in, we can do this. I want the show to be this good. You can make this much. It can be bigger.
You can definitely control the controllables. You can make the show as big as it can possibly be.
Of course.
You can't just magic up the people out of thin air.
No, of course not. Of course not. But then there's no... that. You might as well have it in there that they're going to turn up instead of they're not going to turn up. That doesn't change. It's just your mentality is different.
So when was your... how many days was it in that 170 before you filled it?
Had to sell it. I think 10?
Yeah.
8 or 10? And then sold out maybe... 6 or 8 over the run. I think average maybe, I want to say an average of 110.
Okay.
120. And then last year that number was up.
And you, was that year you
Because I also think, like, you've got the show title thrown, there's a gobo, you're blasting music.
Yeah.
That in my head, when I'm thinking about all that stuff, I'm not thinking about 10 people in a 200-seater when I'm putting that together. Yeah. I'm thinking of it being full. that's when it's going to get the best. Everyone will have the best time because it's designed for people that are packed in. It's going to be loud, over the top.
This is great. Then, this is, you should be writing a book. You should be writing a book about positive thinking. Where does the positive thinking thing come from? Is it from sport? Is it from that thing you were talking about before about your mentor kind of going, how was that coach, 6.5
yeah.
That coaching kind of thing? Because you, like, it feels like this shouldn't be an unusual conversation we're having, but I've never had a conversation quite like this one on the podcast.
Oh, okay. You know? Oh,
like, it's...
I'll take that as a positive.
Yeah. Yeah, beautifully put. But I'm just wondering whether, like, are there... When you say you get anxious about stuff, is...
For sure.
Is the we'll talk about the work-related aspects of that. Is that because you've bitten off more than you can chew, or that you're... I mean, do you have...
I just was living poorly.
Yeah.
That in the show this year, I talk about seeing a mental health professional to learn some breathing techniques. And my wife suggested I go and do it. And in the show, obviously, I make fun of what... she's like, Nick, I'm not sure what it was. It's the... Maybe you're waking up, you're listening to rap music while drinking 4 coffees and watching UFC videos all simultaneously. Those, it's maybe not conducive to, but I, I do get anxious at times. Like I think a lot of people do.
And was it sort of anger management as well? You referred in the show to like breathing exercises, looking at your watch.
Oh,
was that
no,
to
it
do
wasn't
with
anger management.
Or anxiety?
Anxiety. Because in verbal confrontations, I'd go verbally aggressive. Never at friends or family, but ever in my life, I've just never been that person. I'd sit there quietly before having an argument with friends or family, almost to a detriment. You can, you know, if you're not standing up for yourself. Mm-hmm. But if it's somebody at an airport desk, I'll just go 0 to 100. And then the mental health professional's like, well, instead of aggressive, why would you go aggressive? And I said, because passive aggressive... I despise nothing more than passive aggressive. Mm-hmm. And she's like, what about assertive? And I'm like, that's why you're getting the big buck. But I'd get anxious in moments. And then I didn't realize I was doing things that I thought would get me out of being anxious that would actually make me more anxious. I'd listen to rap music or I'd watch UFC videos.
As a cure for your anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thinking you can bravado yourself out of this. And it's the opposite.
And what was the root of that anxiety, do you think?
Who knows? It's probably job-related. There'd be not job-related, just, you know, travelling all the time, drinking beers, you're not living well. I put a lot of pressure on myself.
Well, we've come back to that idea of putting pressure on yourself. What is the outcome... For which, what's the goal towards which you're putting the pressure on yourself? Is it like financial success or fame or a bigger room? Like, what would be enough for you that you would be able to stop putting pressure on yourself? Is there like a sort of an end game where you would, like, if you could visualize yourself going,
think,
now I have enough?
Well, I used to think all of those that it's going to get bigger and maybe you could make more money and do a bigger thing, but it's not. Doing these breathing techniques and everything, you realize it's not about that. When I have those thoughts, all I'm doing is thinking of things I can't control. All I can do in the moment, if I'm thinking about stand-up, get better at stand-up. Be better. Work on it. Because that's my favorite thing, like a new bit working. I love more than anything.
Yeah.
It's my favorite. So... occasionally getting upgraded to business class, I say, how sweet is this? But it's nowhere near as sweet as tweaking my show over the course of a month.
Sure,
and
sure,
it's
sure.
Better.
But you see what I mean? What would represent the end goal for you? Does that question even mean anything to a sportsman? Just to continue that sports analogy, I guess, you know, someone's team can't win AFL forever. Like,
yeah, of course.
Everyone else gives up because we won. But what's the thing that you're working towards that the lack of which would start that frustration? Like, I tell you what, with me, one of the things that gets me very anxious at the moment is feeling like I really want to be as good a comedian as possible.
Yeah.
I really want to be as good a dad as possible. Those things seem very, the tension between them can seem very difficult sometimes.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make decisions about
it. Do you ever try and step out of it and just say, how good is this? I'm a comedian and a dad.
I do.
Yeah.
And that definitely is that, you know, when I'm able to master it in a breathing exercise kind of way and step outside of it and go, actually, this is fine. I've been tense for 2 days now. Yeah. This is actually fine.
Yeah.
And I just mean, like...
You could give you... It actually helps you reset. Because that's what I do. Anytime these thoughts, what about this? Do you want to... You got to hopefully get more people in, do a better show. You want it to go well. You want to be better than last year. And I'll try and stop myself and just step back and go, hold on a second. Get to do stand-up comedy. It's the only thing I ever wanted to do. This is great. And it calms me down. Then I can think, all right, let's logically and rationally go about these next steps, which is what I try and do. I did not used to do that at all. I'd get those thoughts and think, you know what I need? Drake blasted very loud in headphones right now. And then that would actually make me more anxious because you're not thinking about anything. It's just all white noise.
Are you satisfied with your material at the moment?
This show is the best show I've ever done, but it can definitely get better. I can always get better.
Like, you touch on the breathing exercises in this mm-hmm. show. I guess my instinct is that you're not sort of interested in, like, interrogating that stuff in depth.
I will if I can make it funny. For sure. If I can make it funny, because I have one of those, my wife will always laugh. You know, I don't want to have one of those shows where you just lay out anything bad that's ever happened. You know, people, and dad was like this, and mum was, of course you can point out stuff. But I don't want to dig in too deep to certain things just because it's just turning stuff that happened in the past into cash, which is, it's like, why would you? I don't like the idea of that. If I can make it funny, yeah. But I'm not just going to bring shit out just to talk about it.
So when you're writing the next show,
mm-hmm.
is there anxiety about, like, what am I going to say?
For sure. It's already now. Starting now. I'm already thinking about next year.
Yeah.
And again, if you haven't seen my stand-up before, anyone that's listening, I hope you're not expecting to hear some masterpiece. I'm just a fucking bloke. Just trying to be funny for an hour. But know that you know, once the hour starts clicking in, I'm always trying to tighten up little things and get it better and better and better. But then also just chilling out to and have a good time. But yeah, I'm already thinking, well, what's the... Yeah,
sorry,
what are you going to talk about next year? I don't know. We'll see. Like this year, I spoke about the mental health professional, and maybe next year that I could explore that more, possibly. Like I know there's certain... I think sometimes you've got the ideas, but your skill isn't up to getting those across in a funny way. But there's stuff in my show this year that may have been from notes 4 years ago, but I didn't have the skill 4 years mm-hmm. ago to make that bit mm-hmm. funny. But now I can. And there's probably things that have happened this year that I won't be able to make funny for 5 years when I'm better.
I wonder if any comic goes, oh, I'm just not going to worry about writing a new show for 6 months and then I'll start writing and it'll be fine. I wonder if anyone's in that position.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. I'm thinking about it. I say anxiety. It's making anxiety. I'm trivializing it a little bit, but I am definitely thinking about what's the next thing. And I know the more I tour overseas, the window gets smaller to turn out a new show.
Yeah.
And but that just means I have to work harder in that window. Like this year, I got married at the start of February, went on my honeymoon, got back Feb 15th, did shows that night. The night I got back from my honeymoon, two spots. Two on the Friday, two on the Saturday, went away for 2 weeks on the Sunday to do a run of these pub gigs where I was doing 30 to 35 each night, free gigs, at venues where there's fucking greyhound race on behind your head. People are maggot drunk. They're in there for free. Some people, there's some drunk people, there's some people that are there for comedy. And I just think if some of these bits, if I can get people to focus on these bits here,
yeah.
When there's 300 and there's a gobo and my music and people are there to see me, it'll be bananas. That's what I think when that's happening.
You've supported Bill Burr,
yeah.
Jim Jefferies, mm-hmm. Anthony Jeselnik.
Mm-hmm.
Those are three acts of a particular kind, aren't they?
For sure.
Yeah. So why do you think those ones? Do these people that you've met and they've liked you, or are these people who...
No, I just got picked. I just got picked for those.
I suppose because you're a sort of a...
Jefferies, but 5 years ago, I really thought I was... Looking back, I was like a mini Jim Jefferies. Leather
really?
Jacket, fucking trying to tell it like it is.
No,
that's what I mean, the
no.
Points. I can't make points. It's not...
I think that's what I was after when I was asking before.
For sure.
Gone. Okay.
For sure. I was fascinated by
it. Trying to tell it like it is.
Oh, fuck. Disgusting. Gross.
It's a lot of that about.
Yeah.
It's certainly amongst new comics.
Yeah, of course. But you look at... I look at them, and as much as you want to go, man, what are you doing? Obviously, there were comics above me that were looking at me going, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
And you just hope they get out of it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, I'm not, not that at all.
It's really, I mean, how exciting to make that decision before you're even 30. You're not 30 yet, are you?
No.
To have gone through those mistakes and go, God, what am I trying?
I know there's bits from 2 years ago, that 3 years ago, that I wouldn't work now, just based on... My style and out, like it's just slowly changing more and more. I do stand up again. The actual bits are escaping me, but yeah, just the tone of certain things I wouldn't do now. But and I'm sure that in 5 years it'll be different to how I am now, and in 10 years it'll be different to how it is 5 years from now. But instead of freaking out, I'm trying to remember, don't worry about that, just the day to day. Hopefully it gets better. Yeah.
I've been really enjoying asking this. It may go nowhere. Which comic would it be most narratively satisfying if they killed you?
If I got killed by a certain comedian?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. maybe Luke Heggie.
And then
because there's so many things that Heggie, and again, for the listeners, check him out, is just my favourite. It's such a different style from me, but it's so intelligent and beautifully written and very it couldn't be more different from my style, I think. Yeah, there's things that he'll talk about in his show that I am definitely guilty of or was in the past that I find just so funny.
Oh, like the things he's skewering are things you're guilty of.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The little bogan tendencies, you know? I think it would be very funny if he killed me. If there's just too many for him to handle in one friend. He just gets rid of me.
Have you ever contributed against your will? Have you ever noticed a bit of yours come up somewhere else? Have you had a bit nicked, is what I'm asking.
Oh, no. No, because one of the reasons that I like doing stuff about me, it would be very hard to pull off. You know what I mean? Like, if it's stuff about that's happened to me, it'll be hard to pull off without it, you know,
yeah, you don't really
me hearing about
Nick jokes from anecdotalists.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm very lucky. I feel bad for comics that do have these short, sharp bits that are... The thing that terrifies me is I had a line in my show last year that a mate, another comic, Danny McGinlay, said, oh, have you seen Ed Byrne? And I said, no. And he said, oh, it's very similar to an Ed Byrne bit. I was like, oh, shit, that is terrifying.
Yeah.
That is, I'll cut it immediately. Even though I think there were two other comics there at the time saying, it's not exactly it, and you haven't seen it. I'm like, no, I've never seen him. I've never seen him perform. I then saw the bit and went, fuck, that is close. And
yeah,
he's done it better.
Yeah.
It's almost as if he's way better at stand-up than I am. And I was just happy. I go, fuck, that's nice that I had a similar thought to that guy. Got to cut it. I don't know why comics would hang on to a bit that they know is similar to somebody else's bit. That
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I suppose if it's someone else's bit that's on a DVD and is like a recognizable,
yeah.
Oh, this is that person's stuff. But even then, I think, I mean, yeah, if you've happened upon the same punchline, then yes. But I think if you've got the same subject.
Of course. No. That's very different. One of my subjects is about getting married recently. I'd be in deep shit and I would lose 20 minutes from the show. Actually, a lot of comics have spoken about getting married. Oh, really?
Yeah, no, but I know. But I mean, more specifically, if you happen upon a similar punchline from a different perspective, I used to be like, I'd get rid of that immediately. And now I feel a bit more like there's an awful lot of people making comedy.
For sure.
And if you've made your thing, if you are satisfied that it's yours, the worst, the one for me, it's memory. The worst is the idea that I might have seen something and not noticed it go in.
Yeah.
And someone went, but you were at that show. And I'd go, oh, and I'd just have that zoom in, focus out mode and going, Christ, I did see that. And that's where it came from. And,
yeah.
You know, that horrible.
Do you ever ask, I'll ask comics if there's anything close to, it's like if I'm working on it, have you heard anything close to this? Just because of that?
I think this has come up recently. I'm sure I said this to someone recently. I was skiing. I was doing one of the ski slope gigs. At the ski slope gigs, no one calls it. And someone
in France, or the French one?
The French metal.
Yeah.
And I was saying to someone as we were skiing, we were having a little chat as we gently skied down, and they said, because you've got a good memory, haven't you? And I went, no, God, no, I've got the memory of a goldfish. I used to have a goldfish. And I went, that is a demon one-liner. Oh, my God. And then, you know, whenever you fall upon something like that, you basically text Gary Delaney or Milton or someone and go, is this, you know... And I was in the process. I pulled over at the side of the ski slope to text Gary Delaney. And as I was looking for his name on his phone, I suddenly went, it is a Gary Delaney joke. I've remembered it now. He does it with an elephant. I've got the memory of an elephant. I used to have an elephant.
Yeah.
So I did honestly arrive at it separately because I've got the memory of a goldfish because I've got a terrible memory. But I literally remembered hearing him say that joke and went, oh, I didn't arrive at this. It was programmed in the back of my cortex.
Yeah.
Hideous. Yeah. Hideous. And what but if that was the big final callback?
But isn't that nice that you even have that thought? Like, that to me makes me feel good.
Yeah,
you're a step ahead of a piece of shit. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Yeah.
And again, it's those moments that sometimes I'm thinking, what's next, what's next? And then you realise, hold on, I'm doing gigs at a ski resort in Europe.
Yeah.
This is insane.
And you are going to... Do you ever worry that you're going to run out? Do you ever worry that you're going to run out of?
I used to a lot more, but my wife over the last few years says, you know, this is what happens every time. This time, you know, early on in the year when you're trying to put the show together, what happens if, and she'll always say, it gets better each year. You know what's happening. So now I don't fear it. It's almost fun. It was one of the the person said about anxiety. If you're anxious, the worst thing you can do is try and push it away. It's better to bring it in. Like, come on. You can only last so long. And that's the same thought I have with the, got to get the new show together. Now it's exciting. It used to be, holy shit, there's 55 minutes to fill, an hour to fill, and there's nothing there yet. Now it's exciting, like, oh, fast forward 6 months. This thing's going to be full. It's going to be even better than last time. How great is that? As long as you put in the work, it'll be better than last time. So I'm just trying to change my own perspective on how I look at things that would have been problematic in the past.
I was thinking, what a great place to end it, but I actually want to continue with that thought just a little step longer. And it's something I do about if I'm nervous before a gig, I try to remind myself this isn't nervousness, it's excitement. You know, to try and convert it mentally, to do that little mental picture of just going, and it never even occurred to me to do that with anxiety.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't anxiety, it's excitement. And I do feel like with this year's show, my forthcoming Edinburgh show, which is, you know, not in comparable shape to yours, given that I'm doing last year's show here in Melbourne.
It's the reverse. It's what I say, though, to Sloss.
Yeah.
When I get to Edinburgh and Daniel Sloss is working his stuff out and I'm having a great time, I understand the flip side.
Totally.
When he turns up to Melbourne... with this show that he's done 85 times. It's like, of course, man, you've done it more. It's great. Should be better.
But I'm really feeling like this year's Edinburgh show, like it's maybe half of it's there, maybe slightly more than half of it.
But you'll do a big run of trials and...
There's some in there.
Yeah.
I'm also getting married this year and having a stag do weekend, a brunch do. And
fuck,
I'm also
20 minutes
parenting. Not really. I've been trying not to do that. I'm also doing, there's a lot of weekends. I've got a big birthday coming up and I've also got a parent for an entire weekend while my partner goes on her hen party. So I'm like, oh, that's four huge non-earning weekends. That's going to be a lot less cocking about previewing but then, to no one and getting your shit together.
Yeah, of course. And it'll probably be, there's obviously moments in there that are going to be super fun and moments that are really hard. But at the end of that, you've got a whole well of experiences. Some are really fun, some are really hard.
Yeah.
That's how I put my whole thing together. At the time, I'm freaking out. I've got to get married. How am I going to do this while writing a show? Then you get married and you go, oh, I'm so glad I enjoyed that. Like my dad called me 2 weeks before the wedding or a week and a half before the wedding. He said, I saw you the other day. You were just very stressed about trying to get this show together. Mate, you're going to do heaps of shows. You get married once. Stop doing shows for the next 10 days. Forget about it. Enjoy the lead up to this awesome day. And I did. And it was the best move I ever made. Then afterwards, I'm relaxed. And on the honeymoon, the last 2 days, itching to get back to do stand-up. Like, landed 3 p.m., went home, had a shower, off to a show. I've got all this stuff to talk about. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
Thanks, man.
No worries. Thanks for having me, mate. It's great.
So that was Nick Cody. A joy to talk to him. His warmth, his charisma just fill the room. And not just when you're chatting to him, but they fill the room on stage as well. But he has got some big, crunchy, punchy bits of stand-up. He's not just one of those kind of glad-handing charisma guys. He's a very fine comedian. Check out his clip on Conan that we were talking about there. And also do come and see him. Have a little Google of him on the old edfringe.com website. Find out where you can see Nick this August. That's all for now. Thank you to Daryl. Congratulations, Daryl, on your embargoed good news. But I'm pleased to report that Daryl's good news will not be taking him away from this podcast. He will remain our slave. Thank you to Nathan Wood, previous podcast editor, and who's been helping me put together a little project as well. Thank you to Tom Friend and all the guys who've been printing all the T-shirts. Thank you to you if you've ordered a T-shirt or if you've supported the show or emailed me or done anything else to get in contact. Put a little iTunes review on iTunes in whatever country you're in, and generally supported this podcast. I promised you Ivan Aristegueta this year and this episode, and I've bumped him to next episode because Nick's going to be at the Fringe and Ivan isn't. So I cannot wait to bring you that one. Also, we'll have W. Kamau Bell. He's going to be. I cannot wait to talk to him. So we'll have a bunch of Montreal ones to come out at the beginning of the festival, and also Andy Daly. I never like to tell you about people in advance unless they're in the can, in case something goes wrong. But this is in the diary. I cannot wait to bring you a conversation with Andy Daly. He is just one of the finest live and improvised and written and beautifully put together. All of his, download Nine Sweaters now. Buy his album online. It's called Nine Sweaters. It's superb. That is it for now. I'll give you a quick chat, a little post-amble in a moment if you'd care to stick around. But for now, that concludes the podcast. So much to do at the moment, guys. It's going to be a tiny, tiny chat here. All I wanted to say was I'm trying to practice what I preach. I got reviewed at a preview yesterday. It wasn't my favourite preview. The environment was a bit weird. It was a preview in a comedy club where I thought that the audience were all expecting previews, but they were expecting a comedy show. And at the beginning when I asked them, hey, you know what this is, right? Not enough of them said, yeah, for me to have just launched cold into the preview. I should have clocked it earlier. I should have changed gear, done some comparing for 5 minutes, dropped 5 minutes of the show, and then gone into it. That would have been appropriate. On the other hand, maybe it was the right decision to stick to my guns. Either way, it wasn't my best one, and I bloody knew there was a reviewer in. This is not standard. Occasionally, people will come to see you if you, you know, not without asking, but people will come to see you ahead of the Edinburgh Festival if you're confident your show is ready, which I am. I'm in love with this year's show. And then that means that with a bit of luck, you hit the ground running with a good review. Well, we gambled. Did we pull it off? Who knows? I just want to reaffirm to you that I want to practice what I preach. I know the reviews aren't for me. They shouldn't feature in my mind at all. I never want to know when the reviewers are in. They're not for me. I'm not going to read it. I don't care what it says. Obviously, it can be useful. And still, even trying to stand outside of this whole review process to go, look, they're for the audience, not for us. As comedians, they're not for me. I'm outside of it. I don't read anyone's now. I don't read any reviews ever. But they are part of the process. I still invite people to come and review the show, even if I'm not planning to read it. I still want to be able to do the show to as many people as possible, and they are part of that equation. A necessary part, who knows, but definitely at the moment they are tangibly a part of that equation. And I want to apologise to you and to all the guests in the past to whom I've said, hey guys, reviews mean nothing. Look, I'm trying, I'm hoping for them to mean nothing, but I did lock up a little bit because I knew someone was in, and I'm not proud of it. And I feel I've got to confess to you that I locked up a little bit, and I'm not proud of that. And I try not to care, and I still slightly care. And it's like that thing of do the show, don't think about the money. And in the part of your back of your mind, part of you's thinking of mouths to feed, I'm slightly thinking about the money. But it's a commitment. I'm reaffirming it to you. Oh, speaking of mouths to feed, there's the Boutros kicking off in the background there. He's squarely in bed and should be asleep. I'm going to have to go and deal with that. So that'll do for now. More stuff coming at you soon. I'll see you guys in Edinburgh, and I hope to see some of you walking around. If you got yourself one of these Thanks Man t-shirts, wear it. Tweet me a picture at ComComPod of you wearing that t-shirt, and I'll retweet them. I'll speak to you soon. Coming, Boutros!